Evening.
Good evening.
I was unable to attend a couple of classes here for this series, so I'm just wondering how many here were able to read through the entire book. Did anyone miss the Vajrayana section in particular? Okay.
Is that the charnel ground?
That was
the charnel ground. I'm not sure what the
yeah,
was.
Yeah, that's the charnel ground.
That was the charnel ground.
It's not only the charnel ground, but that's one of
them. Oh, the three.
Nine and ten. Chapters right. 9 and 10.
Yeah. Well, so, and did we have? Did everybody have a chance to read the last chapter?
It was mercifully short.
Yeah.
I kept worrying, like, I have to remember to read it. Then when I finally read it, I said, oh, my goodness, it's six pages. I could do that.
Merciful.
Those Dharma minds.
So before, we're going to sort of give a review and over, you know, kind of a look at everything. But I would like to invite questions first if there's something that already is on your mind about what you've encountered so far. And if you'd like to share it, that would be helpful. We're all here to learn from each other.
Well, I think on the very last page, the sentence, may we all learn that pain is not the end of the journey and neither is delight, kind of says it all.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to think that something is forever, or worry that it is, or hope that it is.
Yes.
To be with both and neither at the same time is...
Right. Right. Yeah. That's true. That's true. The important underlying factor of this entire lovely book that we've been reading has to do with uncertainty and change, which basically produces discomfort. So that's an interesting topic, isn't it?
It's the whole topic.
If anything, historically, we seem to be that thing. It seems to be more of a prominent element, uncertainty, having no idea where things are going. Who's in charge, if anybody's in charge? But has anybody ever been in charge?
Well, we like to think we always were.
We always thought that other people were taking care of things on other levels that we didn't have to think about or worry about. So. Okay. So this has been something that is summarizing three aspects of the path in terms of commitments. And the first commitment is to personal liberation. And one of the things I thought about, there are two factors in terms of this personal liberation from the point of view of the first commitment, which has to do with harmlessness, commitment to basic harmlessness, and renunciation. Did that resonate at all, people here? And, you know, I mean, what are we talking about renouncing? Have you thought about that, what renunciation means in terms of the first commitment? What it might mean?
I would say bad habits.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's a good start. Yeah. Yeah. we talked about, we're discussing protecting life. And then the next step beyond just protecting life is to honor it, to view the world we live in as a privileged situation. That's not an easy position to take, actually, because, you know, we see so much misery depending on our circumstances. But if we are actually involved in a path of meditation, then we are actually sort of going beyond a reactive stage and actually and even at an early stage of having some fundamental perception or insight to the wonderment of being alive and everything else. So one of the things that was introduced here, we have a view, and the view is egolessness as basically an understanding of what liberation means. Liberation from neurosis and a renunciation from that very same thing. Conduct, discipline. So discipline seems like a really important thing, right? I mean,
it's always a loaded word, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it is. I mean, sometimes people associate discipline with just sort of like, you know, having to like struggle. And, but there's a notion about discipline bringing joy, you know, because we actually, if we actually can exercise some kind of discipline, and we understand why we're doing this, which is very important, begin to realize that that has to do with some kind of wholesomeness. We're committing to some sense of wholesomeness, of positivity in terms of our being. And we take precepts. So did people, anybody have a chance to explore these precepts, to actually try them out for a while? Like we have five precepts. Not to kill, not to steal, to avoid or refrain from sexual impropriety, not to lie and be mindful in our speech, and a sense of not drugging ourselves.
I always think it's interesting that Thich Nhat Hanh has sort of slightly modified versions of that.
Uh-huh.
And in his sangha, one of the things is the, you know, refraining from intoxicants is too much media, and like even just really thinking about what, like not just like, you know, drugs and alcohol, but what are you taking into your body and mind, which I thought is really a neat way to think about it. Like,
who said this?
So Thich Nhat Hanh's, like that sangha, what they do is kind of you study the five precepts and then at some point you make some commitment to them.
Mm-hmm.
But they really have sort of very, you know, not elaborate, but they spend a lot of time thinking about what do they really mean? What does it really look like in your life? Because sometimes that fourth one is really to not speak ill of others, and mm-hmm. to really think about, you know, how are you speaking about
mm-hmm.
other people? And it's kind of... I just recite them every
day. Yeah, that's a creative. I mean, so I was just... I wanted to ask if anybody had experimented with taking a precept or two for the day to just see how easy or difficult it is. Anybody try it?
That's a great idea.
I forgot.
You know, having just started the book, I got to the five precepts, and I'm in a women's group, and I was using the five precepts in my women's group, and that part about not speaking, you know, really where you sit like a stone, and you think about not speaking neurotically, and you... First of all, look at the external behavior, that whatever has happened, and then you look at internally how you're feeling. I thought that was really good. I've been sort of trying to do that. Listen more, speak less.
Good.
But I've only gotten to about page 60 so far.
I mean, I think it's all worth it. It doesn't matter whether you've already taken refuge, which is kind of more of a fruitional aspect, at least. Setting up a definite commitment, you know, and engaging, but just trying it out. Try out one precept for one day. Don't feel like you have to take everything on, and see how you feel about it. See how whether it's tough or some precepts may be easier than others. But it's worth our while to try this out. I mean, one of the things we're doing here, we're not simply theorizing
mm-hmm.
about you know, the wonders of Buddhism and Dharma and all that. We're actually trying to practice our engage on a spiritual path of understanding what it means to really explore and know ourselves. So this, it means taming the mind. And that's what we're doing or trying to do with the first commitment, is tame our minds so we can actually learn how to take responsibility for the kind of stuff that goes in and out of our minds. And being kind to ourselves and others in that way, so that it isn't like everybody's coming into a kangaroo court or some kind of a judgment. We're not making judgments. We're just truly trying to see and trying to understand directly through our own efforts and willingness to really be here. Yeah.
So another thing that's interesting is I find I'm pretty good at not saying out loud negative things about other people. Mm-hmm. And then I spend a lot of time noticing the things I say to myself. And then the practice I'm working on about sort of accepting just all the parts of yourself is just noticing. I looked at that person and the thing I thought to myself about them was this. I'm not going to share that with other people. That's not the issue, but that's still there. So that's that piece of... And sometimes it's noticing just the biases you have about people. Like, that person looks this way, and then I made this, in my mind, blanket statement about who they are and what they're like without really knowing.
Well, I think what happens is these things do happen, and it's nobody's fault.
Yeah.
But it's more important to see them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, actually, just seeing them and recognizing, yes, it's a bias. And then you can decide if you want to bite into that sandwich or just leave it on the plate,
yeah,
even though it was
say,
offered.
Oh, that,
yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. There's nothing like driving to let you know where you're... To show you where your little yakety judgmental mind is really at. And it's kind of funny in the same sense that Michael's suggesting, just to observe how, you know, you can be have a full day of meditation and go drive home and somebody, you know, butts in line or whatever. And you're like, and it just comes up. It's actually quite humorous.
Kanya Rinpoche talked about how she asked people to notice, which they usually don't after they've sat, done a really good sitting session for a couple of hours, you know, and feel like they really put in time and that they, you know, they get up and then they go out the door and ask if they have noticed the shift.
Right.
Where they're just going back into this mode of automatic,
yeah,
you know, and just letting the thoughts sort of take over their minds. Where does that occur, that shift, that kind of boundary, you know? And that's a good thing to watch, to just see how our minds are constantly involved in a state of trying to get away with as much as possible.
I think in general, though, and this isn't new information really, but you just feel so much better when your mind doesn't do that. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, at least I do. Like, if I'm not being critical of other people, or I'm not, again, flipping the bird in the car to somebody, I just feel better, you know? And
yeah.
I mean, that alone is a reason to try to work on it, you know?
And one of the things we're introduced to in this first commitment is the notion of really just being here, that the kind of, if there's any end point of meditation at all, to really be present. So that if we actually learn how to actually truly be present, we begin to discover that it actually cuts thoughts. It kind of like goes into, it involves a space or a dimension that doesn't get us trapped in our thoughts. And that's a huge relief, actually.
Yeah.
It's a state of positivity. And when we get into the Vajrayana, it translates into something called great bliss. It doesn't mean everybody's having fun and feels wonderful all the time, but it just means that you're free from all the stickiness. You know, like walking through a field of thorns or thistles.
Honey.
Yeah, just you know, like a walking or being a piece of Velcro. You know, that picks up everything that is flying around, right? All and sundry. So we're learning how to refrain from escape. This corresponds to the notion of how we use the internet as escape. How we just use being absorbed and distracted, which is the biggest ill of the age, is that people are so distracted. We're just constantly caught up with. How many times do you see people just stopping frozen, looking at, constantly checking their phone, and where are they? You know, I mean, it's like, are they really present? You know, what does it mean to be present?
At the high school where I teach, the kids walk down the hall and it's just this.
Yeah.
It's literally, there's like hardly, they don't talk. Really, just like,
and they walk across the street where cars are coming.
Scary.
They have no idea and they don't care. They are so absorbed. They could easily get hit. It's dangerous. I mean, it's actually become much more dangerous to drive. The driver has to be very much more mindful about pedestrians who completely ignore the oncoming traffic.
Does that bother Michael?
So, there were two things that I got from this chapter.
What? Question?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, you say go through a day with, you know, take one of these precepts.
Yes.
Looking at them all, the only one we're really thinking about is the intoxication one.
You never think about sex?
Well, thinking about sex is different.
All right, so how would I go through a day thinking about whether I was killing something?
Well, I'll give you an example. So the other day, there was a moth, all of a sudden I had like almost a heart attack thinking, oh my God, you know, the last time I saw a moth in the house at the old place, they had eaten Michael's sweater, you know. Like, right away I just went down the trail like, oh my God, if this, I didn't even tell Michael because I know he'd freak out, so I literally saw the moth and I really thought about it and I said, I'm going to kill it because there's a reason. He'll eat Michael's cashmere sweaters. So I don't know if I got it, but I did. It was very conscious that I'm doing this because I need to. Now, that's not very Buddhist, because there's no exceptions. But there, I have to say that I think there's also a boundary about being awake to your choice. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, it's not that this is exactly totally wrong and that's totally right, but sometimes you have to see, you have to actually be awake to why something would be a certain way.
Or maybe you don't lie you're not lying, or maybe you are lying when you're not telling your spouse that they look awful that day. You know?
Well, you know, somebody might ask you a question, and if you answer that question truthfully, it may not be something that person can handle. It may be something they will completely be unable to understand, and, you know, so you're using judgment if you decide just to avoid answering that question completely. You could answer in some sense of a fragment or a way to even dissuade or deflect the discussion, not because you're unwilling to be truthful, but because you recognize that at that moment it's not going to make sense. I mean, there are times when, you know, there are some people here who teach schools, you know, and you know what the dynamics that are going on in schools with kids and people who have agendas. And it's not like everybody has to go through a final court of judgment. We need to be able to know how to exercise skills. one of the things they're bringing up here, Emily, is one of the things she talked about was discovering a middle way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a good point because,
yeah.
you know, it's therefore, it doesn't mean that because we honor life and we make a commitment not to kill that we just allow pests to overrun our gardens, our lives, all the animals take over. I mean, this has been because animals are taking over each other all the time, and they're killing each other. This is so, you know, how do you manage to hold some kind of a decent level of life in your house if you've got termites, if you've got, I mean, these are real carpenter yeah, oh, yeah. ants, or, yeah. you know, they're eating through right. the walls, and the house is going to collapse.
You don't want that.
Mice.
So, you know, you have to decide that there certain issues override just what we would call hard and fast principles. But, you know, there's no way you're going to avoid stepping on every microbe in the world when you walk down the street.
If you were Jane, he would bring you home.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. still, you would.
Susan has some.
That's the moth. So, since I do all these insect programs, Linda's not here. So, you next time you see a moth, you can, like, just catch it in a little cup and take it outside.
You can.
It was on the lamp, and the lamp was curved. Yeah. So, it was a very specific situation.
There's a story about this. No. Tiny little. I'm sorry.
No, that's.
Yeah, I understand. I've done that.
You can't always do that.
We've done that a lot.
Tiny little moths in my house. I spent a whole winter catching them and letting them out. Catching
them and letting them out.
And they're all coming back in.
No, and then I looked out my window, and there were these all little moth corpses. I had liberated, and they froze. So,
but if that's supposed to be more positive than killing them, because then you're letting them go to their own karma. But that still doesn't make sense, really.
I'm sure they like that better.
Well,
anyway,
we are talking about intent. I think that's
yes, intent.
And so, you know, intention is really is what we want.
Mary,
if you're doing it out of anger and hatred,
right? Intent.
Then you're creating karma that can only repeat itself that way. Did you have something to say?
Well, there are two questions, actually. What about meat?
Down there.
Eating meat.
Uh-huh.
Is that killing an animal?
That's a really good question.
What?
Eating meat.
Yeah. Mm. So eating meat, in terms of at least the way the Buddhists, if you want to know the general topic, there are certain different schools of Buddhism. Some schools say absolutely, under all and any circumstances, you do not eat meat because it's promoting the killing of animals to further your survival.
Or fish either? Is that included?
Yeah.
Fish.
Anything fish. Oh yeah. Sure. Fish are animals. They are part of the animal kingdom.
Anything with a face.
Huh?
Eggs.
Eggs is marginal, depending on who you talk to. Some people say anything you do with any kind of animal product is meat, therefore no. But the general sense is sentient beings who are animals, members of the animal kingdom, and that includes insects. So this is an interesting question, and I know just to share with you the way Tibetans view it, for instance, is that it has to be third hand. If meat's already gone, if it's roadkill or if it's already dead, somebody did it, you didn't do it, and you don't have any direct involvement with the actual slaughter, you didn't order it, you know, for instance, that the difference between going into a restaurant and ordering a lobster, which is going to basically, or a truite au bleu, which is going to be taking a live animal and throwing it in boiling water for you. You know, that definitely, you are instigating that particular act. You're not just, it's not just that it's around and you're eating. So I think this is a personal choice for people.
Isn't that fishy? I've often thought, isn't that fishy? Isn't that odd that we're saying, well, it's okay if Bluey killed it and then he sold it to Frank and then I bought it at the store and I ate it to all those people. You know, I mean, it's a very interesting...
That is. And so I don't think there is any one simple answer for this question. We live in a culture that meat is in everything. If you go to a Chinese restaurant, 95% of everything they serve has meat in it, even if it says vegetables. I don't care. That's just their culture.
Right, yeah.
As an example. So it's going to be very hard to walk the path. I remember once when Trungpa Rinpoche first came to the United States, he was giving a talk in Berkeley, and this guy came up. He raised a question in the question period saying, you know, I don't eat meat. I've sworn off any kind of killing of animals. I don't wear leather because leather comes from animals. It's derived from somebody killing a horse or a cow or whatever. Therefore, I feel like I am engaged on a yogic path to liberation. And Rinpoche looked at him and said, well, you've chosen a difficult path, you know. I mean, how are you going to avoid leather in your life or any other animal byproduct? It could be very problematic.
It is, but there are certain extent that you can. I mean, in other words, I think it's easier in this state to not eat meat than in many other. If you go to Ohio, forget it.
In Alabama, it's not very easy.
Right. But I mean, there are people that don't feel good if they're not eating meat. I mean, they just don't feel physically good.
And there are people who cannot survive without eating meat.
Exactly.
I'll give you an example. I was a vegetarian for a year, and I did a lot of running in those days, and after about 8 months of this continuous diet, I was really, I was even non-lactic for about 3 or 4 months out of that. I started getting heart palpitations. Mm-hmm. And when I went back to meat after a year, and it stopped immediately.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
So even Pema Chodron wanted to be vegetarian, and I heard about this at the Abbey. So she didn't eat meat, but it was really affecting her, I think, red blood cells or whatever. Mm-hmm. And her cook was so mad that she had to have meat from the doctor, told her she really needed this for her health. And the cook quit because,
wouldn't
cook it, right. So, you know, I think about Tibet. I mean, what did those people have to eat? I mean, basically, they had meat and milk products and barley, and that was it.
Wasn't the Dalai Lama told to eat?
So what happens when the Tibetans came to India? I mean, I was with a group with Pungla Rinpoche, and we were around Karmapa, and he became vegetarian. So this is a Tibetan who became vegetarian. But in India, it made total sense to be vegetarian because it was hard to preserve. You know, there's the refrigeration isn't that great. And there are a lot of other options. You don't have to eat meat in India. It's just better not to. You don't even feel like it. So I think the point is that it's good to examine our motives, like Michael said. You know, what's your intention? And then there's prajna to the whole thing, some kind of a clear view of what choice you're making and why you're making that choice. And what is the bigger picture? If you're a violent vegetarian, that isn't really very helpful. You know, like, you're going to lay your trip on everybody. That's not very good.
Yeah. We had violent vegetarian here. It was quite a problem.
But I think that's a piece of people thinking that their view is important and that everybody has to have their view. I mean, I haven't had meat in, I don't know, 45, 46 years. But, that's my business. I mean, I tell people if I'm going to eat with them, but I don't.
Right, you don't.
And I would share with people my reasons, but, you know, they need to, each person needs to decide what are the things they need to do, what privileges does their life give them that they can make certain choices, and what privileges don't they have?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's right.
That if you were experiencing homelessness, you wouldn't have the choice.
We also have to think about the fact that India, which you brought up, is basically a vegetarian culture, and actually meat was forbidden. Classically, meat was considered one of the forbidden foods. Mm-hmm. There were a number of foods that you could not eat if you were actually a Brahmin, or you'd be reborn in a lower caste, which was basically how they tried to keep people in line. And so, interestingly, when you got into Vajrayana, the tantricas, they basically ate all of the forbidden foods mm-hmm. because their point of view, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, mm-hmm. is that everything is sacred mm-hmm. and that there is no such thing as good and bad ultimately and that there fundamentally everything is equal. This requires a certain kind of understanding which comes through establishing more that we're going to go into if we want to make sure we continue our discussion here. Now we'll move into Mahayana. So we talked a little bit about personal liberation. Those things, the whole idea of personal liberation is to free yourself up from being encumbered by these kind of continuous patterns of that bring us into a state of confusion and ignorance. Mahayana is basically moving into a state of caring for others, recognizing the inseparability of ourselves and others and all sentient beings in wisdom and compassion. And there's also kind of a stepping up further in on the plate in terms of a willingness to see things as they are. So that's where we have the notion of bravery. Mm-hmm. And we have the notion of developing through the paramitas, which we've talked about in the past, the possibility of engaging on the bodhisattva path, which is basically recognizing we are here for everybody and everyone, and that our purpose in life is to bring benefit to the world and to all beings. So Pema translates that in terms of another fact, which is another really interesting factor here, not just only people and elephants and tigers and animals you like or whatever else, but also just belonging. What does it mean to understand what the comfort we get from belonging? Belonging is a thing of where we feel like we're being supported by a situation, a group of people who think like we do or who we as all commonly subscribe to the same points of view. This is definitely a belonging, and we like to belong because we want support. I mean, there's no question. And so, but the question is whether what we're looking for and how we find that support. The conventional world is offering all kinds of supports. It's basically saying this is real, and it's how it is because we've been doing it for centuries, and therefore you do this. You do it because this is how we do things, whatever your tradition is. And, this is something where as we emerge towards freedom and liberation, we need to find a way to disengage from. So that kind of tribal identity, which is what this boils down to, and the collective, where we just basically allow ourselves to go along with the collective mind. We don't have to buy into that. But we need to really see it. And we really need to understand it. This is where we're talking about consensus reality and whether consensus reality is true.
So I'm confused. How does this fit into the Mahayana?
Is
this
very much. Because this is part of what we call egolessness of dharmas.
Uh-huh.
This is things. Dharmas are things. So when we say this American culture is real, mom and apple pie is an absolute. You know, that's a belief. And we're turning it into something solid. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we have this, and I'm saying the whole thing that comes along with that, the whole train of values, of associations, of, you know, the nice little Grant Wood pictures of a church and the steeple and the little houses around and everybody's walking around, you know, all pure and clean and all that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, come on, this is not what reality is. Reality is beyond our invention. And we begin to realize that all of these things in culture and humans that we make is an invention. Our language and our associations are inventions. And so when we discover the use of prajna, we're actually discerning. It doesn't mean we can't make use of those things. You know, we don't like throw it all away. But we don't have to be caught up in it and completely become entrapped by it, which is basically where we are until we actually investigate that. I mean, often we just think about how we're going to be kind to each other and learn how to deal with other people who we don't like, and then we employ things like Tonglen. But there's another factor of Mahayana which is very important, which is actually more of a critical approach to the world we live in and why the world produces so much misery, unnecessary misery. I mean, nobody has to go too far to elaborate how much pain and suffering is going on right now. We have an ecological crisis that is threatening the future of this planet, with animals going extinct massively day by day. Hundreds of animals are going extinct every day. And it's like this is cumulative. And this is a result of the way we treat our environment, because it's the way we think about how we're supposed to function in the world. We don't question those things. This is a Mahayana actual activity, is to explore and to investigate. We're using our vipassana, which is clear seeing, to understand whether something really makes sense or not. And can we change? If I don't change, the world isn't going to change. I mean, if I don't stop subscribing to going along with how everybody thinks, how is it ever going to change? All we're going to do is hit the wall. We know that's coming. So we can actually employ Mahayana principles to discern. Discernment, we're talking about discernment, actually being able to understand. I don't have to agree with or buy into everything. I mean, we're looking at a political situation right now which is totally horrendous. You know, every day we're on this roller coaster heading towards some kind of a disaster. Every moment is a complete ultimatum heading towards supporting some completely crazy person in the White House. And, you know, there are a lot of people who, out of fear, don't care, because he's going to oversee the coming of the apocalypse and they're all going to be resurrected because they have been chosen by God to basically be the elected. Everybody else is going to hell. I mean, those are the people who are supporting this. And they think he's fine. He's doing the job that needs to be done. That we all need to come to the end. You know, there's this thing called the latter days. This is what we're supposed to be in, and it's all coming to a glorious end, and Jesus Christ is going to return. Everything else is going to take place, get cleaned up. Everybody who's a real believer will be fine.
Wait a minute. Go ahead. Do you have something?
Tons of big bundles you've put together.
Too much, I know.
Okay.
But Mike was saying, you know, so when you think of Buddhism, it was basically a rebellion against the Brahmin caste system. You can look at it that way.
Yes,
too.
You can.
It was saying, and you know, in the Dhammapada, you know, in his the scriptures, there's always this thing that it's your actions that make you a Brahmin. You know, it's not your birth. And I think they say that's why he didn't take root in India, because it was so revolutionary.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what he did. He said, you know, the caste system is one of the biggest obscenities in
Yes, that's right.
And he said...
He said, no way.
He says, you know, like, who is honest? He alone is Brahmin. He alone is Brahmin. Who is kind? He alone is Brahmin. And, you know, the Brahmins didn't like it.
But,
The Buddha.
That was the, you know, when he, in one sense, it's a very revolutionary religion.
But, in a way, now we're doing the same thing. I mean, we have whole classes of people who are homeless or who are, you know, poverty stricken. And then we have crazy wealth. And in some way, we're all completely intoxicated and we. Kind of like, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
And it's because we worked hard. We deserve it.
Right.
Well, do you remember reading the... I thought it was really poignant to do that smoke offering on the solstice. We went outside and recited the this particular chant around the current state of the world. And, you know, while it could apply in so many different cultures and the main thing is that traditional society has a lot of real big bugaboos, and you know, like, and also nationalism and tribal identity. All these things are forms of solidity, which basically are turning away from the real nature of reality, which is what we want to learn about. And so, in Mahayana, we learn about. The relative, which is basically the way things seem to be working because that's how they are appearing, And then we have the absolute, which is beyond mere appearance, and recognizing that we don't have to be frightened or intimidated by appearances, that appearances are constantly in a state of change. They are not real, because you learn what real is and is not through exercising the principles of meditation and investigation in the Mahayana. So it's not only about compassion, it's also about really rigorous exploration of the way things are.
I just like to, because you're talking about change and talk about India. In the last, I think, 2 weeks, there was this temple in India.
Kerala.
5 million women.
They held and made a wall.
They held hands. They stood.
5 million.
All the women, they held hands and said, because women weren't allowed to go into that temple.
Right.
Because the god was celibate.
That was in Kerala, right?
Imagine that. It was all Muslims, Catholic nuns, Hindu women, all of them holding hands and saying,
So this is a form of recognizing how this paradigm or this particular tradition of male supremacy has to change.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's great that people are joining together, realizing that there is a collective power together by standing together on what you know is true. And I mean, this was inconceivable, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
That's brilliant.
So we're then going into the third commitment. Mm-hmm. Does anybody remember anything about the third commitment?
See things as they are.
Hmm?
We see things as they are.
Yes, but how are things?
What distinguishes
the Vajrayana from the other yanas? The other yanas certainly are committed to see things as they are.
Yeah.
But that's part of the that's part of the awakening. It's just being with what's there and not being like, I'm not going to look at this because it's so bad, or I'm going to push that away. It's like,
but that's also true.
But you go right in.
That's true.
Okay, maybe it's not that different.
Well, I'll just mention something which is really key, which is called sacred outlook. Mm-hmm. Did Joseph bring that up when he talked?
That wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Sacred outlook is recognizing everything is fundamentally pure. And the reason it's pure, because we've been doing, remember, every yana subsequently is encompassing the lower yana previous to it. So the Hinayana and the Mahayana are contained in the Vajrayana. In the Mahayana, we're learning about emptiness. That's when we do the Heart Sutra. We're learning about how emptiness and form are inseparable and define each other. But what that really means is that reality is beyond concept and our ability to grasp with our minds. And that is called emptiness. So that emptiness is not nothing. It's not a vacuum. But it's actually openness. It's just fundamentally something that we have to be able to understand is ineffable. It's beyond our capacity to slap labels, and put it into little categories and file it away.
Empty of concepts.
So when we are free of concepts, this is where we begin to understand what the meaning of purity is. And so that purity is the basis for sacred outlook. And so then, in sacred outlook, though, it's not just a philosophical position or an ideal, which is more viewed as the ultimate point of our work in Mahayana, because that allows us to actually be much more available. There's nothing to hold us back from being available to others and bring benefit to them or to ourselves or anyone at all beings. But this is actually the fundamental point of commitment that we work towards, because it's the basis of truth, this sacred outlook. So that's a real shift.
That's a very important sentence. It's the basis of truth.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, this is what facilitates everything in terms of, because we have not only prajna, that is to say the discernment, the insight, the capacity to understand the nature of things as being completely empty of any kind of characteristics that would in any way make it somehow frozen. It's all open. It's all completely open-ended. But also we are learning about skillful means. We call them skillful means. The term prajna is the discernment, the insight, and the skillful means are actually the called upaya. It's how we learn how to actually be able to relate to the situations appropriately or creatively and spontaneously as they arise. And the way we do that in the Vajrayana is through transformation. We transform our fundamental ignorance and neurosis, all the things we've been cooking around and boiling and seeping and steaming through our heads, bodies, and everywhere else, and actually transforming those into deity or purity, complete purity. Now, deity in this sense is not like a god, like a creator god who's sitting up in the clouds outside. Deity is basically the fundamental nature of our own makeup. And we learn how to do that by taking on these practices to transform our experience from basically crude, neurotic, thick, and completely soaked in egotism and grasping to openness and intelligence and wisdom. And that is, so when we talk about the charnel ground, we're talking about just that.
I have a quick question. Yeah. So you're talking about primordial self.
Yeah.
Okay.
Primordial.
Self. Primordial self.
Well, that word self is interesting.
It's a tricky word.
Yeah, but I'll go. I mean, if we understand self as being nobody, beyond anybody, personal identity, or anything you can stick a label on, or you know, identify as. Yes, it's beyond identity. Mm-hmm. But it is intelligent and it's alive and it's here now.
Can you elaborate a little on the word deity, please?
Mm. Deity. Yes.
Thank you.
How do you want me to do it? I mean, the word?
Yes.
Etymologically?
In this context.
Okay, so deity, in this sense, we have deity. There are not just one deity, but many deities. Because, in other words, if everything is... We learn about aspects of enlightened mind, which we personify as deities. Now, these deities are expressions of awareness which manifest in different ways. They can manifest as male, or they can manifest as female. They can manifest as wrathful, they can manifest as peaceful.
Let me interrupt, because yes. what you said was that, if I don't remember exactly, you said the deity as a reflection of our true nature. So I'm not challenging, I'm just sort of curious.
Yeah.
What makes our true nature, or recognition of our true nature, which is a really interesting concept in and of itself, what does that mean? A deity. Why do we even use the language of deities?
Right.
That's what I...
So we use that because, and it's like, we don't have to. This is a path for people who find that important. There's different aspects. We can do Vajrayana without necessarily the deity practice, but that's more involved.
I think it's more about worthy of veneration, so that we can all see ourselves as having that potential for being awake. And that, therefore, we're all deities in that we have the same potential as the Buddha. That is the most...
We are the Buddha.
Exactly. Okay, that's right. But that's what's so interesting about Buddhism. It's not that you're basically bad and then you're going to get fixed. It's that you're basically good. And that open, primordial awareness is your birthright. That's who you actually are. And therefore, you're starting from the awakened state. We all have that. It's not somebody out there has it. And therefore, we all have the potential to be awake. We are that. and we are therefore all deities, but not in...
Well, the deity actually has to do with recognizing everybody's Buddha nature as personal expression. So deity is not just some kind of abstract notion floating around. It's actually living presence. And ultimately...
Deities are selves, because we are both the feminine and the masculine in ourselves. We are the deity, not just that it's a symbol of something.
No.
It is our own deepest nature that we are making love to ourselves in some sense beyond being caught up with anything.
Beyond duality.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And we're making sense of ourselves, mm-hmm. okay? And that the left and the right are united within us, not some symbol of something.
So I think the use of the word deity is always something that we can get hung up on,
yeah.
and that is loaded in our culture, probably in any
but
culture.
But different in here, because we create the deity, when we're doing deity practice, which is called, this is why we're talking about it like
right.
this, is we actually do a deity practice. We create this deity. We are visualizing the deity, but in the process of visualizing, we're recognizing that as inseparable from our own nature, and it's being used as a means to transform our minds, so that our minds can actually come to a point of supporting the recognition of Buddha nature. Everybody is Buddha in this room. Everyone who is a sentient being is a Buddha. The difficulty is simply that we don't recognize it. And so what this does is pave the way. It trains the mind and makes the mind supple so that the mind is not in the way of that recognition. And ultimate recognition, which is going to be the final stage of the teachings that come in Buddhism, has to do with resting in the simple recognition of that, of the simple realization that everyone is Buddha, and that everything, all appearances, are expressing themselves in this pure way.
Buddhas are us.
Yes,
that's exactly right.
We can buy all those old stories.
When you
start,
exactly.
You
said sacred outlook. Is this what you mean by sacred outlook?
Yes, absolutely.
Buddhas are us.
To me, sacred outlook is more about the whole world. You know, like the world is sacred.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
We are the world.
We are the world, and the world is and the world is sacred. The world, everything is pure. The difference is that there is a difference and that you might encounter somewhere, and it's very possible that somehow a lot of people think the world is just sort of a prop that we have to get liberated and move on to some other dimension. But in actuality, the world is the expression of our awareness. Of awareness itself, not just anybody's personal awareness, but because awareness itself is not personal. Awareness is everywhere. And our awareness is not just some private kind of thing. Everyone is awareness. And awareness is coming through our perceptions and our experiences and all the things we see and feel. And so...
That sounds pretty sacred.
It is. It's ultimately, and so this is actually what we call Buddha mind.
So, and centralizing it becomes the problem.
Yeah, there's no centralization. There's no conceptualization. Even though we're using words to talk about this, it's all beyond words. It's beyond our mind's grasp of the mind. But the mind can be there to help us work with that. The mind is not going to go away. What is deeper than the mind is a primordial wisdom, which is fundamentally wakefulness. So we could say, simply put, it's what is here and now as it is.
Praise Jesus.
Okay, it is, I mean...
That's gorgeous.
Questions? Does that help? Are there any kind of doubts? Or
at the rapture, all the other people...
Do some check.
So I want to quote something. I was doing the Heart Sutra today, mm-hmm. and sometimes when you read something and you just have a fresh look, something pops out. And it said, Therefore, Shariputra, since the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they abide by means of prajnaparamita. So, you know, we're all trying to get somewhere. You know, isn't this the point? You know, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to feel better. I'm going to get somewhere. I'm going to be nicer, whatever. And then it says the bodhisattvas are the ones we think we want to be. They have no attainment. Well, how can this be? No attainment.
The work is so hard for no attainment.
Believe me, I don't want this religion. But then they abide by means of prajnaparamita. And prajna, that wisdom, that awake mind. And it's transcendental. So that's, the Heart Sutra is considered Mahayana, but it carries us forward beyond.
Therefore, there is no fear.
That's right. Therefore, there is no fear.
And they transcend falsity.
Since there is no obscuration of mind.
There's no obscuration of mind. They transcend falsity.
And attain complete nirvana. So, the last chapter, we are needed. This has to do with getting, you know, sort of understanding what we've just explored together and realizing that there is no longer a time for being lone wolves. This is a Hopi statement that she makes in here. That it's important that we understand that when we get on this boat which is our path, we say, a path of our journey, that the journey is not to get to other side, because you just basically need to be on the journey itself. The journey is the goal itself. This is what Trungpa Rinpoche said again and again and again, that the path is the goal itself rather than something after that. It's basically being here. And that our place on this planet and our means to embark on the path of the genuineness is provided in the three yanas. And that, so that's basically what the summarization of this is, but we are not alone, and that we are here to be together and work together and to understand, explore the phenomenal world together. This is, you know, it's not just sort of an academic exercise. It's actually understanding what it means to be here and finding out what those possibilities are. So I would like to leave you with that thought as a commitment.
Which one?
Oh, Michael, Mary Esther, it's one. It started at about 8 o'clock.
One this long is one thought.
Okay, so.
Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gorgeous.
I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you, and I look forward to seeing you all very soon next week.
Thank you.